This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to take a look at recent U.S. foreign policy. Our guests are two policy analysts, one a Democrat, Anatole Levin, and the other, John Holzman, a Republican. The two have co-authored a book on foreign policy that calls for the U.S. to change the direction of its policy. The book's title, Ethical Realism, A Vision for America's Role in the World. The two authors wish to see the U.S. move in a direction that would establish American power on a more limited but firmer basis and with greater international support. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guests. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guests. John Holzman is a former senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He is a member of the Foreign Relations Council and a contributing editor to the National Interest. Anatole Levin is a former journalist who is now a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. His writings have appeared in many publications, and he contributes regularly to the Financial Times and the International Herald Tribune. The two are the authors of a number of books on foreign policy. The book they have co-authored, Ethical Realism, A Vision for America's Role in the World, is published by Pantheon Books. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Anatole Levin and John Holzman, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
To begin with, I just gave the shortest kind of description of the two of you. I would like for each of you to tell us a little bit more about yourselves and how you came together to work on this book.
Well, speaking for myself, this is Anatole Levin talking. I've always considered myself a liberal, but at my previous job at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, which considers itself to be a very liberal think tank, I became increasingly disillusioned with the existing policies of the Democratic Party and of many Democrat intellectuals and their failure to set out a brave, coherent, and effective policy alternative to the Bush administration. John will speak for himself, but we met and got together because I think he was going through the same process with regard to his conservative allies. And we basically, from the point of view of what we've called ethical realism, or John won't accept that. I think of it also as progressive realism. I know. We discovered we just had far more in common with each other than with our so-called respective camps. And that we really perceived a kind of malign bipartisan consensus in Washington, which we think it's essential to overthrow if America is in fact to have a real and effective new strategy.
And John?
This is John, and again, thanks for having us. I think Anatole and I, we became friends at this event, and of course in Washington, part of the problem is that, you know, if you're good at doing TV or radio or speaking, you're kind of like a gunfighter, and you have a little entourage of people telling you how great you are and the other people do, and there aren't many people good at it, and your job is to try to knock each other down. But what Anatole and I realized was that, A, we agreed, as he said, about far more of the agenda than we disagreed about, and that the tribal arguments were a little bit like the Sharks and the Jets in West Side Story. People fight over turf all the time, but when it comes down to ideological differences, both parties really agreed in terms of Iraq and other things about the same thing. And we really rejected this, as Anatole said, malign new consensus, which basically, you know, and even Baker Hamilton is a great example now. We both strongly support most of it. But the reality is it was a consensus about what's going on in Washington and not a consensus about what's going on in the rest of the world. And even after the debacle in Iraq, everyone we talk to says, you guys are right to have a more limited foreign policy, but still be internationalist, work with allies, see things from other people's point of view, except in the area where I study, except in the area where I'm interested, in which case the United States should basically dictate to the rest of the world what ought to happen. And we see Iraq really as a philosophical failure. It isn't about Iraq, but it's a failure of a whole way of looking at the world that both parties have championed. And we wanted to go back to the indigenous roots of a very different kind of foreign policy championed by political practitioners like Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower, to some extent Gerald Ford, who just passed. And on the other hand, we wanted to look at some of the thinkers and philosophical precepts behind this that are uniquely American, Reinhold Niebuhr, George Kennan being two of them, and Hans Morgenthau being a third. And it struck us that there was this indigenous alternative that was being horribly overlooked, and rather than keep making the same mistake over and over again, we should really go back to first principles.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about these three important thinkers who propounded ethical realism in the 20th century, and tell us a little bit about what you mean, or what the term means, ethical realism.
Well, what these men exemplify is the fact that there is such a thing as the ethics of realism. Because you find again and again people saying, oh, ethical realism, that's a contradiction in terms. The only realism is this kind of very cynical, harsh realism of Henry Kissinger. Well, this is both completely wrong, but also very strange, because Niebuhr, Kennan, and Morgenthau, I mean, have some claim to be three of the greatest, or perhaps even the three greatest American thinkers on international affairs. And their work, they were all realists, but their work was imbued with ethical thought. I mean, this is most explicit in the case of Reinhold Niebuhr, who also has some claim to be the greatest Protestant theologian who America's ever produced. But Kennan Morgenthau, too, wrote continually of the moral obligations of the state, of the limits placed on what the state can do by ethical considerations. But they insisted, in a way that the Bush administration, the neocons, but also, I fear, many Democrats have forgotten in recent years, that a policy which has no serious concern for its likely consequences, which takes no responsibility for the consequences, which doesn't study the likely consequences of actions, it is not moral. However moral its stated goals may be, if you ignore all these things, you're not being moral. You are being deeply immoral and, above all, irresponsible. And I think that is what we have seen in the decision to go to war in Iraq, but also in many of the other policies adopted by the Bush administration, but supported, alas, by many Democrats.
Hmm. Another idea you write about in this book is the great capitalist peace. Two questions here. What do you mean by the great capitalist peace, and how does it fit within or alongside ethical realism?
I mean, I think we'd say that it's a really unique period in history when there aren't competing economic systems out there. There are two really key trends in the world. One can be seen as a carrot, one perhaps as a stick, which really unite most of the great powers of the world. And part of being an ethical realist is realizing limits, realizing that the United States, although certainly first among equals, likely to remain the greatest power in the world for the foreseeable future, is not alone in the world, and that to get things done, you have to work some of the time with other great powers, particularly countries like India, China, Russia, and dare I say it, even with regional powers such as Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Syria, not always very friendly regional powers, but to get things done in a region, you don't get to pick the people that you work with. But the two basic points led us to say that there is the basis to have a reasonable community of civilization, as Cardinal Richelieu put it. One of these is capitalism, the fact that most of the countries in the world now accept capitalism. Now, capitalism varies greatly between a much more state-centric model in places like Russia and China to a much more laissez-faire model, say, in the United States, but that all the countries accept capitalism as the basis for the global system in which they live, and that most of these countries, for their own desire to perpetuate their regime, want that global order to continue. And so there is the basis to talk to countries like China, which has benefited immensely over the last 30 years. I mean, people, I'm in my 30s, and you know, when I was born, the Cultural Revolution was going on. Compare China's development now to then, just in a blink of an eye, historically, in Chinese terms, and you can see that China has indeed moved toward capitalism, has benefited from that, and that is a very positive trend. So if we can talk to countries on the basis that they have a stake in the order in which we live in, as well as we having a stake in that, many things can be accomplished that seem as though they can't. The stick, in effect, the negative side, is that of all the great powers in the world, be they in Europe, be they these great land masses like India, China, Russia, none of these countries want to be blown up by al-Qaeda. That al-Qaeda are the true barbarians of the international order. They cannot be negotiated with. They cannot be dealt with. They wish to overturn that order. That is something that all these countries in the world have in common in terms of their interests. So we've seen Iraq as a huge diversion away from the primary enemy of the order that we live in, which is, of course, trying to preserve things as they are, and that al-Qaeda should be dealt with and not Iraq. And, of course, al-Qaeda's gotten far stronger because of what we've done in Iraq. The first rule of counterterrorism is to deny the terrorist what he wants. And what we've done through this has become a recruiting bonanza for our greatest enemies.
Mm. You say it's useful to look back to the challenges that faced Truman and Eisenhower in the post-World War II world. And one of the accomplishments you laud Eisenhower for was how he steered clear of the temptation to attack the Soviet Union in an effort to prevent war. How was he able to defeat those who thought that was the way to go?
Well, partly, it must be said, through a certain degree of what one can only call cynicism. I mean, Eisenhower won the 1952 elections on a platform of rolling back Soviet power in Eastern Europe, which, as he himself privately always recognized, was very likely to lead to nuclear war. After he came to power, he forced his own supporters, men like Dulles and others within the establishment and within the Republican Party, to confront this truth that if they were, in fact, or if he were, to adopt the strategy which they had committed themselves to, there was a very good chance that the whole world would be destroyed. We hope, I must say, that a future American president, whatever they may be saying or may say in future as candidates, will be capable of doing that, will be capable, essentially, of repeating Eisenhower or indeed repeating Nixon and Kissinger's behavior when, as John mentioned, they sought detente with China even while China remained an extremely savage communist power. But Eisenhower's wisdom was not just this. It was also his wisdom in recognizing two things. One was that even if America won a war against the Soviet Union, the Russia that it would inherit would have been completely impossible for America to run or to transform in a successful direction. The other thing that Eisenhower recognized, and that this administration has once again completely forgotten, is that American power does not just depend on its military. Fiscal security, fiscal responsibility, economic strength, and, as he himself stressed again and again, care for the well-being of the American population are critical to America's national strength and national security.
And what's your view of our situation in terms of fiscal responsibility today?
Well, I mean, I speak as a conservative, and I have to say that President Bush is doing a pretty good impersonation of Lyndon Baines Johnson. He's taken the budget surpluses of the Clinton administration and led us into these ruinous deficits, spent money like water. He's created a new cabinet-level post in terms of the Department of Homeland Security, which is the worst-kept secret in Washington, is an utter bureaucratic disaster. We've merely created new levels of bureaucracy, further retarding our ability to deal with some of these problems. We have really had an assault on civil liberties, which I, as a good social libertarian, find appalling. The reasons I became a conservative have to do with personal liberty, fiscal restraint, balanced budgets, local control, good Jeffersonian stuff. And one of the things, as I worked at the Heritage Foundation, and Anatole and I shared, was this notion in Washington that people had forgotten these really basic principles of the founders, and that, you know, people like Eisenhower were talking about the military-industrial complex and a garrison state, that this entire tradition of American thinking had been neglected. And when I see President Bush, I see big government conservatism, which is similar to French Gaullism. I'm not that thrilled about it in Paris. And I'm certainly not thrilled about it in the United States, because civil liberties, balanced budgets, local government that's energetic and accountable is the reason I became a conservative in the first place. It seems to me the neoconservatives have hijacked this message, and it's up to us, people of goodwill in both parties, to restore really this kind of American tradition, which has been sadly neglected, certainly to our detriment.
And Anatole Levin, as a liberal, what's your view?
I entirely agree with most of this. Of course, John and I differ very considerably on many domestic issues. We couldn't have written a book together on American or indeed probably any other domestic policy. But when it comes to, and so, you know, our spending priorities within the United States would probably differ very radically. But when it comes to the need to balance budgets, opposition to the kind of policy which has really put America in hock to China to a very great extent, and the need, once again, to perceive American strength as residing in a whole spectrum of factors and not just, you know, the number of aircraft carriers or tanks that one has. John and I are completely at one.
Mm. What do you think that new Congress will do in this regard?
Well, I think our fear, I mean, the new Congress will certainly push to bring the troops home, or there will be a push within the Democratic caucus, particularly from the new members, to do so, because, of course, that Iraq was 75% to 80% of the agenda. The election was successfully nationalized by the Democrats, but the older members and the newer members are going to have trouble seeing eye to eye. The Democrats didn't have a plan for Iraq. They had 7 or 8. And the reality was they were wise enough to say that all we have to do is unite to say, you know, the Bush administration are the guys that brought you to the dance, and they're the ones who are responsible for this. The problem now for them is that they will become very soon culpable in things if there is indeed a surge without a new plan, if the Baker Commission is disregarded, and increasingly to both our horror, it looks as though it may be, or at least large sections of it, such as talking to Syria and Iran, which would strike us as a no-brainer. You know, in diplomacy, you have to talk to people occasionally that you don't agree with. You can't just talk to Canada all the time. And this is something the Bush administration has really forgotten. And so the problem for the Democrats is that they will be tarred to a lesser extent as being part of this same consensus. And at the same time, of course, the president makes foreign policy. Any reading of our Constitution sees him as first among equals. And there's no way the Democrats are going to pull the plug on funding for the war. Of course, pulling the plug on funding for Vietnam, although it may very well have been the right thing to do or the wrong thing, but it's hard the Democrats for a generation as a party not serious about national security, the McGovernite wing of the party taking over. And so I think the Democrats really are in a good deal of peril at the moment, and we're all waiting on the president. But, of course, what the president's saying here and what's going on in Iraq are two entirely different realities. And this is the practical problem with ignoring the philosophical and ethical roots of realism. If you don't talk to other people, if you don't study other countries, if you don't have, as Jefferson said, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind, it isn't that you do those things just because they're nice and they're the right thing to do. You do them because practically that enables you to have some slight grasp of the reality elsewhere in the world outside of the Beltway. And it's very obvious from what we're hearing about what's going on within the White House, within the administration, that they are so far behind the curve in terms of reality that even if they catch up a tiny bit, it's a day late and a dollar short.
Yeah. One of the things that the Bush administration has been criticized for is for shutting out advice that runs contrary to their worldview. Does that remain the case?
Well, yes, it seems so, certainly, from their response to Baker Hamilton. Many of us, including, I must say, myself, got this completely wrong. We thought that Baker Hamilton were going to be a way in which the Bush administration could listen to outside advice and, you know, bring themselves back from these obviously failed strategies in the Middle East, but not at all. The president and his supporters have simply, as John says, brushed these recommendations aside, and all the evidence is, we have to wait, of course, to see what the president says, but at present, all the evidence is that Bush is just going to recommend more of the same utterly failed policies, more troops, more money for reconstruction, which will just be either poured into the sand or, frankly, stolen not just by Iraqis but by Americans. And we're just going to lose thousands more American lives, tens of thousands more Iraqi lives, for nothing. And the whole stinking mess is going to be deposited into the lap of his successor, whoever he or she will be.
Yeah. You've mentioned Baker Hamilton now a number of times. What are your thoughts about what's needed for Iraq?
Well, it seems to us that the thing that Baker Hamilton did well was to realize that you needed a regional strategy, which in our book we are constantly advocating that you can be a global superpower, but, you know, as Anatole wrote, to paraphrase Tip O'Neill, all even geopolitics is local, and that it's great to have carrier groups. But the problem is that they don't do very well in landlocked areas, whereas if you're Saudi Arabia, Iraq, for Iraq, that's a rather important country because it's next door, and that you have to talk to the neighbors, that you have to try to gather support among the neighborhood. A great example of where that worked for the United States in the 1990s for all the problems in the Balkans was in creating a consensus among both European countries and other Balkan countries, such as the Greeks, the Bulgarians, the Romanians, to try to stop what was going on with Serbia. And because there was this agreement, the Russians were unable to upset the balance of power when it came right down to it in that area. And, of course, in Iraq, you have exactly the opposite. There's been no regard for what the neighbors think, for what their interests are, in the country. You could make a very good case right now in Iraq that the neighbors could all be brought on board. Nobody wants the three to really split apart. An independent Kurdistan, of course, makes the Turks go queasy and would draw in both the Turks, the Syrians, and the Iranians possibly into a regional conflict. The Saudis are terrified in the south that the Shia will be independent and are largely autonomous in Iraq because they have their own Shia problems in the area where, of course, they pump more oil than anyone else in the world. And so they don't want the whole thing to fall apart either. And even Iran, which has been the big winner geostrategically in the region due to American mistakes, don't want to fight the Sunni again in the center of the country. Of course, they did that in the 1980s in a disastrous World War I-style war with over a million casualties. And so you can certainly make an argument to them that as you've won, why let the whole thing unravel? And then your winnings would indeed be endangered. This is the kind of discussions we should be having. But we're still stuck at the point that we're not sure we want to talk to people that we don't like, which is light years away from reality and light years away from solving these problems. You have to talk to regional people. And we like that Baker Hamilton began by saying, yes, we need to get out, but we need to get out as part of a broader strategic and political plan to leave something in place. And the problem in Iraq has always been political. I mean, the administration have utterly forgotten Clausewitz, have utterly forgotten the military is merely a tool with which to move politics along or not move it along. If the Sunni could be brought on board as stakeholders in Iraq, we have more than enough troops and intelligence to deal with the insurgency. If the Sunni are not brought on board, as they have not been brought on board, and the execution of Saddam is just the most recent example, if the Sunni are not brought on board, no number of troops will ever be enough to bring the country to something approaching peace. This is the way we have to think. Our criticism is philosophical. The whole way that people have been thinking, particularly neoconservatives, but also most or a majority of Democrats, is the problem. We are not drawing on an inert tabula rasa. The rest of the world is not a blank slate for us to fill up. And by not understanding that basic reality, the Truman and Eisenhower and Morgan, Niebuhr and Morgenthau and Kennan understood so well, we've really let the whole thing go horribly wrong.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon are two policy analysts, one a liberal, Anatol Lieven, and the other a conservative, who we just heard speaking there one moment ago, John Holzman. The two have co-authored a book on foreign policy that calls for the U.S. to change the direction of its foreign policy. The book's title, Ethical Realism, A Vision for America's Role in the World. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. One of the things that you write about in Ethical Realism is the danger of seeing the world in terms of good and evil. How do you see that playing out today in terms of, let's say, the language used to describe Islam and the Arab world?
Well, first of all, I should say that we both identify Al-Qaeda and its immediate allies as a genuinely evil force with which it is not possible or sensible or pointful to try to negotiate or seek compromise. Our whole book is directed towards making the struggle against Al-Qaeda and its allies more effective. But beyond that, we say two things. One is that if you look at considerable number of terrorist organizations like the IRA in Northern Ireland, for example. The U.S. has been able to deal with them. Indeed, the British have been able to deal with them and have, in the end, managed to gain political agreements with them. So not every organization in the world that uses terrorism is like Al-Qaeda. Secondly, it is ridiculous to suggest that the U.S. either has or can pursue a strategy in the world of not talking to governments we don't like or governments that are in many ways bad. As John has said, I mean, this negates, I mean, not just the whole of American history, but the whole of human history. It's not just that you have to talk to governments you don't like. As, by the way, we talked to the Soviet Union through most of the Cold War. We made essentially a treaty with communist China. But also that even within states which are in many ways bad, there are usually different factions and different forces involved. In Iran, for example, though this has been hardly reported in the U.S., the pragmatic, moderate camp in the Iranian establishment, led by people like Rafsanjani, have just won local elections against Ahmadinejad and his radicals. That means that there is something to play for within Iran by talking to Iranian moderates, by offering them agreements that they can accept. We have a way of influencing Iranian politics, Iranian policies, in ways that will help our own objectives elsewhere in the region.
Let's talk with a listener now. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I agree, actually, with everything you have to say. You know, diplomacy, I don't know, what's wrong with this country? Recently, there was, I think it played before, the front line, the dark side. And it was talking about, before going to war and all that, with Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz. I think there's a real ethical question here of why are not these people held accountable for their actions, that kind of thing. I for some reason, we just sort of go on, but, it seems, with the smoke and the mirrors or, the cooking, the books, the way I look at it, why isn't there some kind of, price that's paid or something or other. I don't know. What's your view of this?
Well, I strongly agree with your caller. I mean, I think one of the jobs of people who are policy analysts and think tanks is to hold people accountable. I always begin my speeches in Washington by saying, I'm an old-fashioned analyst. I think I should be judged naively on my analysis. And people have come up to me and said how dangerous that sounds. But that's how it works in a democracy. If you give advice and it leads to catastrophic outcomes, I shouldn't take you seriously. A leading neoconservative, Michael Ledeen, who supported Mr. Chalabi, who was going to be the George Washington of Iraq, who had last been in Baghdad, I might add, in 1958, when the Dodgers were playing baseball in Brooklyn. Mr. Ledeen and I testified before the House International Relations Committee about what to do on Iran. And I listened in horror to his view about how simple it would be to overthrow the Iranian government, how bombing might have to be used, but that it would be simple and easy and we could easily topple this government. And finally, I had to say, and when it came time for me to speak in as gentlemanly a way as possible, this is the man who brought us Chalabi. This is the man who helped bring us the disaster in Iraq. Why in the world would anybody listen to him about what goes on in Iran? Anatole wrote a great line in our book about people in favor of preventive war, such as James Burnham, who was an ideological nemesis of our three heroes, Morgenthau, Niebuhr, and Kennan, and says, in effect, would you take advice from an investment firm if they've been wrong for 60 years? It was wrong to promote preventive war against Maoism, against Stalinism. It's certainly been wrong in Iraq, and it would be wrong again. And yet leading Democrats like Peter Beinart and leading Republicans among the neoconservatives are promoting exactly the same failed policies that have been failing for 60 years. The reason they get away with it, I would argue, is because we don't hold them accountable, that Wolfowitz didn't know the casualty rate, that he said that the war in the medium term wouldn't cost anything. That's my personal favorite. It's a $500 billion mistake with the meter running. The fact that the rest of us aren't out there banging the drum constantly, really is a danger. And the danger is that vampire-like, some of these guys are going to rise again and continue to really destroy American foreign policy. It's up to the rest of us to hold people accountable to what they say. That's the basis of informed government in a republic, and we need to be better at it.
Yeah, and the other one, just the final point, is that the history of the Middle East and the British Empire and all that kind of stuff, for some reason, people in the government forget. I just can't understand it. So anyway, very good program.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You point out that there's really no real foreign policy debate underway in the country at the moment. Why? How did we get here?
Well, there is a certain debate in the media, and I think Baker Hamilton have advanced that debate. There is more talk now, much more talk about the need to talk directly with Iran and Syria than there was, say, 2 or 3 years ago. But this hasn't really spread, unfortunately, to Congress, to the elected representatives of the American people, and to the Democratic Party, who are, after all, the opposition to the Bush administration. You have more and more Democrats calling for an early withdrawal from Iraq, but John and I are not for an unqualified early withdrawal from Iraq. It's true that simply pulling out without setting any kind of regional framework to replace the American presence is very likely to lead to a ghastly regional conflict. But the Democrats, I have to say, unfortunately, many of them are simply too scared of the domestic unpopularity that would result, to be able to take the kind of radical stances, radical not in the sense of left-wing radical, but radical in the sense of new thinking, which the present disastrously lost war in Iraq demands. And by the way, let's not forget, it's not just one lost war. Shamefully, largely as a result of having plunged into Iraq, at present we're also losing the war in Afghanistan, where, after all, the war on terror began with 9/11. This dual, looming dual disaster demands a much more honest and searching debate than we are seeing at present in American political life.
Just to jump in, one of the reasons that Afghanistan is going so badly, we're called in NATO for new troops, particularly European troops, to help us fight in the south against the reconstituted Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And we're hearing nothing. The British are already overextended, so they can't do it, but the rest of the allies aren't choosing to help us. One of the reasons they're not choosing to help us is because of the horrible bad blood that has built up among our closest allies as a result of the Iraq War. That's part of the price you pay for Iraq that nobody's talking about, is when you call upon people to do something that's in their interests, in your interests, that's been agreed to by everyone, where a coalition was assembled in Afghanistan rather brilliantly by Colin Powell, where the administration did act in a moderate, reasonable way. All that is forgotten and goes out the window because of their being a bull in the China shop earlier, and this is the price we're going to be paying in our foreign policy for the foreseeable future. Even our friends are not eager to help us when it's actually in their interest to do so.
John Holzman and Anatole Levin are our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. They are the authors of Ethical Realism, A Vision for America's Role in the World. Let's take some more calls. Next we go to a listener in Urbana. Line one, hi.
Hi. I'm calling to ask if the authors have found any U.S. grassroots local groups or internet connections that have the potential for snowballing action that would put some pressure on the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress to refocus off the peripheral stuff and focus on this terrifically significant problem that is worldwide, that we've messed up so much. Why is the country sitting so quietly? Where do we need the students to lead us, or haven't we got any brains of our own?
Well, alas, I think a lot of people have come to feel very hopeless about their ability to influence their elected representatives. Again and again, you see people going into Congress and essentially compromising and compromising and compromising. The most hopeful things that I've seen recently have been in the form, frankly, of military protests against what is happening. Because, of course, as is now being said more and more, the present strategy is breaking the U.S. military, and by the way, the British military as well. Now, I am in no sense an advocate of mutiny, and I have, you know, grave doubts about soldiers actually refusing to serve, whatever the circumstances. But I am encouraged by the fact that more and more veterans, and indeed more and more serving officers, are using their rights as citizens to protest against a strategy which is disastrous for not just for the United States in general, but for the U.S. military in particular.
I think the other really positive thing is that with Baker Hamilton, the president bought himself some time to cool things down, obviously because there was this groundswell for Baker Hamilton, this bipartisan groundswell of you know, a form of ethical realism that was brewing. The president said, I need to study this, and thereby the holidays came, weeks passed, and the whole simmering began on the pot began to go down. The president next week is going to have to come up with something. If he advocates a surge in troops without a diplomatic strategy to match it, I think you will see open ruptures in the Republican Party. I think people like Senator Hagel, who are increasingly giving an eloquent voice to more of the Eisenhower-Truman message, I think you'll see more of that. I think the other thing that you're likely to see as time goes on, of course, is the other thing you're likely to see as time goes on is the primaries are very likely to bring up candidates where this is going to be discussed in great detail. I think the 1952 election is really the comparison that we were talking about. The fact that Eisenhower and not Taft was elected as the Republican standard bearer meant that Truman's policies were by and large continued by the Republican Party, and you had broad bipartisan agreement around an ethical realist policy. I think that the new election coming up in 2008 is the most significant foreign policy election since 1952, and people in both grassroots organizations in both parties ought to get out and ought to support candidates who ask and answer probing questions about what's gone on, because if they don't, we're going to get more of the same, and if they do, we can genuinely begin to right the ship of state. Of course, like a Spanish galleon, if we pull on it now, it will take a couple miles for the ship to turn around. I think that's the same with what's happening now, but I do think there's the beginning of this thing unraveling in a very positive way.
I want to thank the listener for her call, and we're going to take another call now. Caller in Urbana on line 2. Hello.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
The contradiction seems to be, how do we conduct overseas wars of imperial aggression without violating fiscal responsibility? The Nuremberg laws, I mean, simply invasion of a non-belligerent state. Lest we forget, the headlines on every German daily in October 1st, 1939, where at last we fight back. And how different was the U.S. press from that? It's just can't be done. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, I mean, when it comes to wars like Iraq, essentially we would agree with you. We think that they have been disastrous in every way for America's reputation and indeed for America's fiscal stability. However, we should say that we do not regard by any means every war that America has been involved in as a war of this kind. Both John and I strongly supported and continue to support the war in Afghanistan because although we knew that it would also lead, alas, to abuses and civilian deaths, we regarded it as morally and legally justified as a response to 9/11. And, of course, because it was morally and legally justified, it also enjoyed the support of the great majority of the international community, which initially, at least, until we threw away that advantage in Afghanistan, made a tremendous difference to the success of our operation there.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line 3. Hi.
Hi. One of the things that bothers me about the argument the last couple of years particularly, when we were starting this back before we invaded Iraq, the neocons were rather open about admitting that they were thinking about imperial policy. Wolfowitz, Pearl, what's his name, Friedman, who wrote the article in the Atlantic Monthly the summer before the war broke out. He was actually praising second century Roman Empire and the 19th century British Empire as a model for American foreign policy in the Middle East. There was no talk about democratizing Iraq.
No, I think that's right, and I think that that's an example of the Bush administration changing horses midstream, meaning that first it was weapons of mass destruction was the main reason we were doing this. And, of course, when the weapons weren't found, the rationale changed rather radically. Suddenly it was democratization of the region without thinking through how that would be done, how long that would take, who would do it, how it would be implemented. These are the questions of policy that Anatole and I, the rest of the responsible people in Washington, deal with every day. And the problem was that they became trapped in their own evolving slogan. In one sense, it was a very clever thing to do, because unlike Mr. Blair, who really did nail his colors to the mast, that it was all about WMD primarily, and then when it wasn't there, has paid a huge political price for it not being there, by the Bush administration, chameleon-like, blending into the next argument, they managed to survive it at a much more popular level for longer. But the problem was I think that some of these guys began to believe some of the slogans that they were bandying about. And, of course, without the basis to know, for instance, historically, the Ottoman Empire divided Iraq into three provinces or vilayets, one around the Kurdish area in Mosul, one around Baghdad in the Sunni area, and one around Basra in the Shia area, and knew full well that there wasn't an integrated nation there. Without knowing a little bit about the history, the politics, the sociology, the economics of the area, this sloganeering led directly to disaster.
Why do we keep doing this over and over again?
Well, I fear my previous book was about American nationalism. It is to some extent because of in itself a very positive side of the American tradition, which is this belief in democracy, in the Constitution, in freedom, in human rights, and in a belief which John and I share, that America has a duty to spread these values in the world. But where people go wrong is in two things. One is in believing that America can do this by bullying people, by believing that America can spread democracy while at the same time demanding that other countries abandon their most vital and cherished interests. And thirdly, the intense impatience with which, alas, too many people in the U.S. establishment approach these issues, this belief that you can transform not just Muslim countries, but, you know, countries like Russia, for example, with no history of democracy, that these can be transformed into democracies, you know, by the wave of a magic wand, that, as John says, you add water and you get George Washington. This we profoundly disagree with. We believe in America spreading democracy, but above all by the force of its successful democratic example, and even more importantly by helping to lay the bases for stable and successful democracy over time. And alas, in most cases, and certainly most cases in the Middle East, this is going to take a very long time. And frankly, under the Bush administration, we have made an absolutely disastrous start to this process.
Mm. No, I mean, I think one of the things that they've confused is pro-American outcomes and democratic outcomes. They're constantly flabbergasted in the Middle East when someone like Hamas wins a relatively free and fair election who is not pro-American. And if there were free and fair elections in Egypt, Mubarak, our ally, would have fallen in the Muslim Brotherhood, not our friends, would have won. This is repeated all over the region, and even in Europe with more established democracies. President Chirac and Chancellor Schroeder, no friends of mine, merely were following the dictates of their people in opposing the war. The Turkish parliament, and ultimately opposing America's incursion from the north, was following the wishes of 85% to 90% of its people. The idea that if you're a democracy, you're going to fall in line behind American policies confuses nationalism, democracy, and pro-American outcomes in a profound way that would be just absolutely hysterical to any freshman who studies intro to IR if it weren't so tragic.
Hmm. We have to wrap up here, and I apologize to a few listeners that we've left here on the line, but we're just simply out of time. Your book was published last fall, the fall of 2006. What response is it getting, has it received from policy makers, policy analysts?
Well, a very good response from policy analysts. The writer in the Washington Post just before Christmas put us actually at the head of all the books recommending new American strategies in the wake of the Iraqi failure. So in the policy analyst community, it's doing very well indeed. Alas, as far as the Bush administration is concerned, well, perhaps we didn't expect very much, and we haven't received very much. But then, as we've been saying, that has been true of more distinguished people than us, including Jim Baker and Lee Hamilton.
No, I mean, I think I join in. I mean, you know, it's been gratifying that between the New York Times review, the great piece kind of anointing us, and of course from us, as Kennan is one of our heroes, to be said we're in the race and winning to be the next George Kennan, you couldn't say anything nicer to me than that. And so in terms of where we're heading in the future, and that we have a blueprint based on both philosophy and then taking that philosophy and making policy from that philosophy, I think it's been really gratifying and wonderful. As Anatole says, though, the jury is out, because until you can talk to policymakers, where even amongst people as diverse as, you know, Hillary Clinton, Senator Hagel, Jim Baker, Lee Hamilton, we've had some very, very positive feedback. Frankly, I don't think we expected very much from the Bush administration. I see them locked in one room of the White House with the blinds down saying, everything's going well, stay the course. I think groupthink has taken its toll there. But the great thing about America is it is a correcting mechanism. The next election is coming up, and frankly, everything is to play for, and I think our ideas are ideas whose time is about to come again.
John Halsman, Anatole Lieben, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks
great
a lot.
Pleasure.
John Halsman and Anatole Lieben are the authors of Ethical Realism, A Vision for America's Role in the World. The book is published by Pantheon Books.